You just clicked play on your new favorite podcast, To the White Sea, and you're expecting a recap if you're good at pattern detection. Well, there's a new pattern in town, and it's called Live Events.
This Thursday, April 13, at the Dunkunsthal Gallery in Manhattan, 64 Fulton Street.
At 7:30.
The evening is called Xander Robin, Mutations in Nature, Hidden Florida Movies.
Our guest on this week's episode, Xander Robin, will be appearing live in person.
Xander is going to show some films that he's never screened before publicly. And then he's also going to show some photographs, and he's going to talk in between the films, and he's going to show a film that he was shooting just a few days ago to screen on Thursday for the first time. It's going to be amazing.
Hell yes. Now, on to the recap.
We open on a U.S. Air Force base. They're doing bombing runs every night onto Tokyo. They're going to do a firebombing within the week that is bigger than anything they normally do. We meet Muldrow. He's a boy. He is modifying all his weapons and prepping his ship and his guns. He's a tail gunner in a B-52. He gets confronted by a bigger guy. He has a pull-up contest with him and deflates him. That guy's sidekick comes to him and asks him for advice about the bombing run they're about to go on. They go out on that bombing run after he shows them some flints and says, you can make fire with these forever. And then they're out on the bombing run in the darkness, and they're seeing what is happening at the end. Oh, no.
Boom, boom. Yeah, good. Although I think you might have even gone a little ahead.
I really squeezed that in there.
Sick. No, you had like 3 seconds to spare.
That's crazy. I could have used those.
It was way better than mine last week.
Nice.
Let's introduce the guest. This week, we are so excited to have our friend and fellow filmmaker, Xander Robin. He's directed some amazing films and episodes of TV. He directed a film that we're going to talk about a little bit called Are We Not Cats? And some episodes of Chillin' Island, some amazing shorts.
Lance Lizardi. Upcoming feature film, Lance Lizardi, now a short that you can watch on Robin's website.
Hell yeah. Very talented filmmaker. We're super excited to talk to him today. So welcome, Xander.
Hello. Hey, thank you. Thanks for the intro.
And we're going to talk some Coens.
Yeah, I'll probably behave like the Coens do on their commentary tracks with lots of pauses and 30 seconds where you just catch them watching the movie. I don't know if you've ever listened to it. Yeah. No, I'll be less boring than the commentary. But yeah.
You can be whatever you want to be, man.
Well, do you want to pop in the DVD of To the White Sea right now? It's a terrible segue.
No, it's good. No. I'm pushing the eject button, but it's the opposite of eject because the disc has been placed in. And it's sliding in.
To the White Sea, episode 6.
Pages 11 and 12. Back to Muldrow, still staring impassively out at the clouds. There is a momentary glint, moonlight against metal in the distance. Muldrow does not visibly react, except his hands tighten on the guns. The pilot, looking down at his radar, he reaches over his head and throws a switch.
We've got something coming above and behind us.
Muldrow, softly.
I see it.
Waist section. The port gunner stirs and pushes his mask down, while across from him on the starboard gun, Red is sweating and breathing hard.
If he sees him, why don't he shoot? Christ, I can't see him.
Tail bubble. Muldrow stares out through the bubble at the night sky. It is dark and empty. Then, suddenly, flashes as the enemy pilot fires. Bullets rip into the tail section of the plane. The plane rocks. Muldrow coolly pans the twin 50s as he hunches forward to peer through the gun sights. Waist section. We hear the ack-ack-ack-ack-ack of the enemy guns.
Jesus, what's the matter? Why don't he shoot?
The bombardier looks impassively over at Red.
Take it easy, pal. We're just getting started.
Back to Muldrow, peering through the gun sights as more bullets rip into the tail section, a couple puncturing the plexi bubble. He still slowly pans the guns. His point of view through the gun sights shows muzzle flashes, ending, the sky going black. The enemy plane is now invisible. Muldrow continues to sight, seemingly on nothing, as he pans the guns, moving in the same direction and at the same pace as when he was tracking the flashes. His finger tenses on the trigger. Through the sights, we see blackness, no target. Muldrow pans, staring down the sights. His headset crackles.
Muldrow?
To the White Sea. To the White Sea. Of all the things I'd like to see, to the White Sea is the one I cannot.
The gunner is shooting out of a plane. This is a flying plane.
It's a big. It's a big plane.
It's a flying fortress.
Exactly. Yeah. This is something we covered in the last episode. Is that I was thinking of it more like Top Gun, but this is like more like the size of like a commuter jet that you would fly on. So it's got like five people in the front, and people in the middle, and then people like towards the back of the plane, and there's like bubbles coming up. So there's basically like guns sticking out of the back of the plane, and the tail gunner.
It's like these are machine guns, or are they like?
They're enormous machine guns. If you want to like maybe a reference that's more familiar is like the guns in the first Star Wars film, how they're these are guys that are sitting in kind of.
Yeah, I was thinking of Full Metal Jacket. Get some. You know that guy?
Totally.
He just keeps saying, get some, get some, get some.
Is that a helicopter gunner, though?
It's a helicopter gunner with an open door.
This is an airplane. This is an airplane that's the size of like a 747 that's like way up high in the air. And it has almost like gopher hole plexiglass bubbles coming off the side of it through which guys are looking. And they're remotely controlling these like swiveled gigantic guns that are basically pointing off the left and right side of the airplane. Mm-hmm. Imagine the airplane's going forward and it's going to drop all these bombs on a city. So it has guns positioned to the left, right, and directly behind it. Muldrow, our protagonist, is in the very, very back of the airplane, pointed directly behind it, shooting backwards, basically, anyone who's chasing them.
Wow. And he's aiming at planes.
Tinian Island is this tiny little island with just basically a bunch of airstrips on it. It's within like 5 or 7 hours to fly to Tokyo from Tinian Island. And I guess along the way, they have to protect themselves if anyone intercepts them.
These are Japanese fighter planes that are specifically trying to prevent them from getting to where they're going.
Because these are big, slow-moving, heavy, you know, it's a plane full of bombs that has to get right over the city and then just open up the bay.
How practically do they want to shoot some of this stuff? I mean, once you get into planes, I'm just thinking of Hell's Angels, right?
Like this sequence, how would they film this? Yeah.
It's a really good question.
Yeah, I'm really curious. I know that a big issue with this film in general is that they wanted to shoot it on location in Japan, which I think would have just added so much specificity to the entire film.
On most of their movies, do they build sets?
Yeah, like I think they build a lot of sets.
Like Lebowski, it seems like there's a lot of sets, but some of those are fantastical. But like Barton Fink, I feel like that's a lot of that's a set, like the hotel and stuff, right?
Oh yeah, the hotel is a great soundstage set.
Yeah, they're big on. They're definitely very much about building sets. I'd be curious actually to know which of their movies have on location stuff. Like I would imagine some of the stuff in
Burn After Reading,
yeah,
for sure.
I was gonna say Fargo. I would imagine some of those interiors are, but you really never know. I mean,
in some instances it's hard to say. Is it cheaper to shoot on location? Depends. Sometimes actors want to film it in a certain city, otherwise they won't do it.
I have an idea about how we could figure out how they would shoot this sequence. I think we should look at the Angelina Jolie film Unbroken.
Oh,
yeah.
Which is
the one she directed?
She directed it and is shot by Roger Deakins, and I believe it has...
She has curly hair, right? I haven't seen the movie.
It has sequences in Japan.
I think they're in a B-29, or they're basically... all I can say... is it would be a Roger Deakins sequence from the same decade with the same kind of technology available that is shooting like interior scenes in a large like bombing airplane.
Yeah, it's not something we've talked about, but Unbroken is such an interesting alternate like side path version of To the White Sea, just in terms of so many of its elements, like you're saying.
Yeah.
You have to imagine some of it could have just been transferred whole cloth from like what he was thinking about.
Oh, okay. There's a different movie that she was in.
This is a movie that she directed. That the Coens wrote the screenplay for, and Roger Deakins was the cinematographer for. And it's fascinating to look at it, to look at the shots. It's like a lot of the same.
I also literally forgot that they wrote that screenplay.
Oh yeah, that's one of their like Bridge of Spies era like commission screenplays.
I love Bridge of Spies. Yeah, this movie made $115 million. Wow. Totally was not paying attention.
I watched it on a plane. It was very moving.
What year was it? What was going on in our lives that year?
2014.
It's a lot going on.
Yeah. I mean, this happens all the time. You know, a man named Otto. Like a movie could come out and make $100 million and you don't really notice.
Especially a movie like that or like American Sniper, where that movie's consistently making money, not necessarily in New York City or major metropolitan areas, but
Yeah.
Like smaller cities, smaller towns, people are just going.
Yeah. But what happened to the Ridley Scott movie, Last Duel?
It had more of a cosmopolitan appeal, I would say.
Last Duel. I haven't seen it, yeah.
Oh, you should check that out.
Yeah, yeah. I plan to eventually.
It's a wild film. It's also just like a peak COVID production film too. I feel it's like just seeing photos of those guys in those costumes at the height of COVID was like a big part of the like wallpaper of the experience. Yeah. You know, yeah.
I wonder if in the future you'll be able to tell the movies that were made in like 2021, because there's just something off about it. Like just about how
I think that's extras. Money in the bank. Yeah, I think it's definitely there.
Lack of location shooting. Yeah.
Clouds behind people's eyes as they try to like act out a scene.
Yeah. People will be writing about that for sure.
Do you want to go into the, or just tether back into the pages we just read a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I'm amazed that the script is so short for like a war movie, right?
89 pages is such an interesting length for a screenplay.
Xander, you're kind of like the indie short feature impresario. I mean, when I look at your movie, the fact that it's 77 minutes, I'm just like, beautiful. Yes, I love it.
That has something to do with money. Not having any, I think there were like sequences that were in the script that were not shot, things like that. I kind of feel like 2 hours is like the perfect movie length, two and change, or like, for like a thriller, maybe a little bit less than 2 hours, for like a drama, a little bit more.
I was just watching, Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, the
great movie, the original. Yeah.
The original. And just like when I saw an hour and 40, I was like, hell yes. The fact that they're going to do this in an hour.
100 minutes is perfect. Yes. Yeah. 100. But you know, you never know. You film things and you have to cut them out and you want the ability to like try some other things. And I don't recommend making an indie movie for, you know, when we shot. It was less than $100,000. That was like an $80,000 movie. Misguided.
No, but I feel like you had the confidence to be like, this can kind of work and flow like an animated movie a little bit. I don't know. I just rewatched it yesterday and I felt like there was like a, you don't dwell on anything too long. Like you really just like make the scenes the right length that they're going to be. And you like went with the lean and mean final product.
I appreciate that. The last thing you would ever want to do is be boring when making a movie. And making anything is it's a shot in the dark. You never know. Someone will find it boring.
And you wouldn't have any executives tell you that you didn't save the cat.
Okay.
Sorry. So I guess like my big takeaway from these pages is that we have two like really specific points of view. The crew and the super experienced guy. And then we have the red character who's kind of like our POV character who's just like, what the fuck? What the fuck? Start shooting. Shoot, shoot, shoot. And they're just like, we're not even there yet. Don't worry about this. This is a very big plane. We do this all the time. We're going to take our time. And even if you can't see what's happening, like we're in control of this, which is an interesting emotion for like the first action sequence of a movie. Typically, this could be the space where like they go out and shit immediately hits the fan. What actually happens is they get attacked, but everybody is acting like they have this.
The pages we read end on like an unbearable moment of tension because everyone's waiting and the danger seems so present. And for some reason that we don't quite understand, he's strategizing not to do anything.
Yeah, actually, there is actually a little bit of a flip there because when the pilot says Muldrow, you do kind of get the sense that the pilots are starting to crack a little bit. They're starting to be like, okay, dude, like we know you're looking at something that we can't see. Are we going to take these guys out or are we about to like get our plane shot up again? I don't know. How did it read to you, Xander?
I usually don't like read things at face value at first. I'm just like, wow, like it's cool how funny this is. I'm glad there's like, you know, seeing the Coens like do a war movie. I'm just thinking about like the humor they're putting into it. And then I'm just like, yeah.
What about this was struck you as humorous?
Not these two pages. Some of the pages be like how we got to this point. Yeah, the two pages is just it's the conundrum of you're in a plane and you're shooting at something and you don't know what the fuck is going on. it seems terrifying, and also maybe it's a little existential too.
How so? What makes it existential? Well, sorry to keep putting you on the spot.
Interesting. I've read it three times, and it's hard for me to have an amazing take on it. I'm just like, okay, because it's weird when their script is. I guess the first take when I'm reading the script is like, it's amazing how directed this is.
Did you read the whole script?
No. I just read up to this point.
Okay, cool.
I'm just like, okay, they're directing everything.
Yeah.
We see, you know. I don't know if this is normal these days, but I feel like the scripts, the blacklist script that you read, and I've probably read like, I don't know, maybe I read like 30 different like scripts last year of just like random people's scripts, and none of them are written this way. They're all written basically.
They're neutered. Like, they're fucking neutered. They're written for people who don't ever want to direct a movie.
Yeah, they're not directed. They're basically written for agents, right?
Yeah.
For agents to read it and be like, yo, that was pretty good. Like, you know.
They're not visual.
Yeah.
Can you tell me something that you're seeing in these pages that you're not seeing in contemporary screenplays right now?
Sure. Yeah. Every single time it says close, close, close. Every single time it describes what the camera does.
Yeah.
It basically just, it tells you exactly how they're going to make the movie and exactly what you're going to see. You know, these days, I guess, for some reason they say, and I don't know if I agree with it or not, that okay, instead of saying it's a close-up, just describe what you're going to see. So like, you know, describe the
we like see the a veins, big face
the veins of the citrus, right? Describe someone's veins. Okay, you know it's a close-up, but they're actually just like being like, no, fuck it, we're just telling you what it's going to be. And it's a more professional way to write in a way, because
it's a blueprint.
I guess, yeah, it's an actual blueprint. It's more of a shooting script, really.
Yeah.
And these days, scripts are sort of written as like specs to get executives and people that work in the film industry to like get traction on it and stuff like that, which is...
They're written to be rewritten.
Yeah. Which is almost like closer to literature, which is cool too. It's just sad that... I don't even know if that's working and helping people get their films made. Whereas this almost shows more confidence in that I actually know how to make a movie, that they're describing the details and which things are made. I was telling Ray, I was reading, I'd watched McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and then I stumbled on the script for it. And the script is just like, it's all blueprint descriptions. It's not emotion. And if there is emotion, it's sort of, it's just like all like, it's like a giant cluster of text. It's not like spread out the way scripts are written now. Everything is sort of spaced out. And it's closer to a blueprint of what the movie will feel like and what you're literally going to see. I'm wondering if we strayed too far from God here.
Well, I would just say, if you're writing a screenplay and you have visual ideas, put them in the screenplay. That's like my main, buy this argument that it has to be. I just think ultimately, like, you're setting yourself up and you're setting your collaborators up for something that feels mushy if you write without very much like visual interest. Or
and sometimes it's like you want to say, it's like, oh, just save that for when you're making the movie. Or you know, people even say that about like music or something. It's like, oh, don't put that in there, just save it for when you're making it. Or save talking about like what the score will be and how it'll feel.
I think they balance this out by having some of like the tersest prose possible. You know, so there's a lot of descriptions that are added in the action, but it's not like overwritten at all.
It's a very good counterpoint. Is that they're not there being like, the camera moves with a little bit of a shake to it because the guy holding it feels like he's scared of the plane too.
It's some of the most efficient writing ever, but their stuff is like, will cast like a sensory spell over you at times and will become so pleasurable to watch. You kind of enter into this different state. You know, I definitely feel like in this section, there's a bit of a spell cast over me through like the tension and the, like, I don't know what's happening, but I know this guy is in control or something.
Cack, 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 cack.
Yeah.
It gives you what you need for sure.
The story is allowed to sneak up on you a little bit when they describe more of the things that are happening besides just dialogue.
Xander, you said that you were, like, when we first reached out to you about this, Xander, you said you were excited about this because you're kind of a fan of James Dickey in general.
I haven't read the book Deliverance. I've seen that movie a lot, and I've been thinking about that movie a lot, and I saw that there was, I just think it's really cool that Has he done any other, has he written any books that became films? James Dickey?
Those are the only two I've ever heard of. The other thing I know about him is he was the American Poet Laureate for some period of time, I believe, in the 80s.
And he's in Deliverance, too. Yeah.
Nice cameo.
We found out about this morning.
It's really more than a cameo. I mean, he's the sheriff at the end, right?
Yeah. I mean, he's the one that says, don't come back. You're not going to come back here, right?
Yeah. He's staring the audience down in the face, being like, I wrote this shit and it's fucked up. It's fucked up what we do to these people.
As this script, you've read the rest of the script, but are there any thematic comparisons? Yeah, because Deliverance to me is really, it's about, our relationship with the natural world.
Yeah.
What we do to it and also how we, treat certain members of society.
I just rewatched it getting into the groove for this episode. And you guys saw it together, right? Yeah. You saw it on 35?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we saw, I think this was 2019, before the end of the world. We saw it on 35 at Metrograph. I've since seen it a couple times. And that was probably the first time I'd watched it in years as well.
Yeah, that was, for me, I felt like once I turned 30, the film took on this totally different level. That was the first time I saw it as an adult and not as a teenager.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, whenever I mention that movie, I'm writing something and I mentioned that it's somewhat similar to Deliverance, and then everyone's like, it doesn't have a rape scene, right? I'm like, no, it doesn't have a rape scene. That's people's takeaway of that movie is the squeal like a pig thing, where it's, I just think about the river being dammed and being turned into a lake and destroying this town, and then the sort of rush for these city, Atlanta, but city folk to come and check it out before it's gone, not knowing that they're kind of rubbing it in the face of, they are basically the same as the people turning it into the lake in a weird way. They're kind of the two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. They perform the same function of casual destruction, where you're pretending you're not doing it, but you're doing it.
Yeah. And I think that aspect of the movie is why there's so much depth to it. And that movie did lead to a bunch of because I was like, oh, what are movies similar to Deliverance? And I found a bunch of copycat movies because that movie was so successful, but they're all kind of not copycats of the right aspects of the movie. It's all people go into the sticks and get fucked with. Wow, look how evil and crazy these
these people,
these yokels are. Yokels.
These hicks. I would say
exploitation.
The two movies that this made me think of were Avatar and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And sort of my somewhat maybe a little too bumper stickery reaction is this movie is the missing link between the Coens and James Cameron, just in general. You could just tell from their films that they watch this movie a lot.
Well, I mean, sometimes they veer into action film territory. And this film, I think, would have been them being in just action sequence after action sequence after action sequence. If anything, it reminds me of First Blood a lot.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is ironically a pretty left-wing movie when you actually watch it, compared to where Sylvester Stallone ended up.
For sure.
Or maybe what Sylvester Stallone's politics are on the surface. Well, I guess we could talk about it.
Yeah.
We don't have to necessarily talk about it.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting. Who knows? I don't know what his politics are. I mean, it's like Clint Eastwood. Sometimes his politics get viewed as right wing, but sometimes they're viewed as kind of populist. Because I fuck with Richard Jewell so hard. And, we talk about High Plains Drifter and
how. Love High Plains Drifter.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add one more thing, which is that when I was watching Deliverance, which, by the way, I watched Deliverance for the first time. This was my one and done.
Wow.
Deliverance.
Why didn't you watch it beforehand? What were the things about it that were maybe not today?
I think its reputation preceded it in my mind. One of my big reactions was are we actually going to get to see the lake get flooded? For me, that was the ticking bomb. And part of it made me reframe a little bit of Oh Brother, which is a movie that I have some misgivings about, just in terms of the plot and where it goes and what its interests are. But then when I watched Deliverance, I was I feel like if I rewatched Oh Brother, I would be watching the teenage Coen brothers' vision of what the flooding of the lake looked like in their minds when they were watching Deliverance.
Yeah.
Which is just another way to say that Oh Brother includes specific plot points that are set up in Deliverance, and it's interesting.
But not shown.
But not shown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I wonder if they're in the book, they show the lake being flooded. But yeah, I mean, I guess it would happen after, yeah, the events of the movie.
Can you imagine if they cut to like 1970s miniatures and had like a shot like that at the end of Deliverance?
Yeah, I heard the studio was trying to cut the budget on that movie so much, which is why everyone did their own stunts.
Which is crazy when you watch that scene or all of those canoeing scenes. And like Burt Reynolds like hurt his back doing it too.
Yeah.
I think that maybe is like why he's laid up in part of the movie.
There is a really similar thing in To the White Sea and in To Deliverance of just like a sense of like people going to travel to this whole landscape that's about to be destroyed. That's such a specific kind of territory to enter. You're like, I'm an outsider. I'm going to go to this place. I'm just going to skate through it really quickly because it's about to get just wiped, like miles
into the White
Sea.
It's about to get wiped out because it's a war.
Well, they're gonna do this massive firebombing, not tonight, but it's coming up later in the week. They're not sure when it's gonna be, but it's gonna be like a Slaughterhouse 5 Dresden type
atrocity.
Yeah.
So the Coens never made a war movie, right?
No, but we've been cataloging aspects of their movies that reference the war. Like you have a lot of characters who are going off to war. Like you see that in
Barton Fink. Yeah.
Yeah. Or
the atom bomb in Hail Caesar kind of like lurking in the background, kind of like the military industrial complex is like a
Hail Caesar.
Love Hail Caesar.
Yeah. I just rewatched Rear Window, which is pretty off topic, but the shot of the atom bomb on Jimmy Stewart's, like the black and white photo of the atom bomb on Jimmy Stewart's like little mural of his photojournalism at the beginning of that
totally
movie. Or it looks like the atom bomb. It might just be like a big cloud of smoke with like soldiers standing in front of it. But like that reminded me of Hail Caesar, where the guy shows him the picture. It's like these like weird little artifacts that come back to the home front.
Totally. Or it's like stuff in Llewyn Davis. Like there's like the Cold War is present in Llewyn Davis, but like so it's only through that soldier Troy that he meets.
Oh yeah, and the soldier's great, great character.
The kind of sense of a space race that is in the content of that song they sing.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Yeah.
Great.
There's like the dog food commercial in Lady Killers. It's a dog holding like a can of dog food, like bounding through a fake like foxhole situation with like powder explosions. Can I do one more Deliverance thing? And it's relevant.
Yeah, of course.
I'm just wondering, like, did you watch those scenes when you did the little Yachty episode of?
In my like original, like, you know, I made like a video that was just like, I guess like a rip-o-matic type thing.
Explain to people what a rip-o-matic is.
Yeah, you use clips from other movies and you kind of make like some kind of cool mood reel to get everyone excited about a vision for something.
Yeah.
And so I made a couple for each episode and yeah, I used a bunch of clips from Deliverance. But you know, we're doing Deliverance kind of superficially because, you know, we were not going to put anyone in actual harm doing the show, even though a lot of terrifying things did happen when making that show. That car flip is real.
Can I ask you, that Chillin' Island is kind of a magic trick in terms of being like, which parts of these are staged, which parts of these are documentary. Can I just ask you rapid fire some things?
Sure, yeah.
When Dap falls out of the perch, is that real?
No.
Okay, so that's staged. When the car flips over, that's real?
That's real. But then we filmed a part where it happened, and then we kind of added to it on an additional day.
Okay, so there was an accident, and then you wrote narrative to then pull out of that footage. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really starts the whole show off on just this giant question of how bad was that? How much of this is real? It's really, really confusing.
What about making fun of Yachty and him storming off? Like how much of that was planned?
That was fake. So it's sad when people are like, fuck the Chillin' Island guys. They shouldn't be making fun of him. And it's like, yeah, Lil Yachty had to go. It was like a scheduling thing. We didn't want it. We didn't want the show to feel like there was a scheduling problem. And he did get mad at them because they don't like Pink Floyd. And I really like Pink Floyd. So I was down to show them being, my opinion, wrong about it. And Yachty being right. And I thought it was so cool how much he liked Pink Floyd. And then he just came out with a Pink Floyd-esque album.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like that episode is kind of beautiful in the context of like the creative work that he did, like while it maybe in the time, like maybe the stuff he was working on when he filmed it or shortly afterwards in terms of.
There was a song on that album it's called Say Something, that I had heard as we were finishing up the show. I'd heard an early version of Say Something, and I actually really wanted to put that in there, which is the lead single on the album.
Yeah, but he wasn't ready to put it out, right?
No. And it wasn't like finished. It wasn't like mastered or anything.
Yeah.
I don't think I was supposed to hear it anyway.
But some of that vibe kind of leaked.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was cool knowing that he was going in that direction.
Can I just put one thing more into the chapters or into the pages? Okay, so I think that this whole section ends on this tension of like not knowing exactly what Muldrow's doing, him waiting longer than anyone else is comfortable with. And I think the one thing that really sets you up for understanding what he's doing here is that he's basically executing the advice that he gave Red a couple pages earlier, which is get them fighters on the pursuit curve and let them slide down the string just like they showed you in gunnery school. Even if you can see them, don't shoot first because then they can see you. As much as it's mysterious that he's suddenly gotten silent and that he's not responding in the way that you would anticipate that he would. They set it up a page earlier. Yeah. That this is what you do. He's in control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The key line for me in these pages, and like what jumped out to me so much, is there's a momentary glint, moonlight against metal in the distance. And just that feeling of, you just know, especially if you've watched a lot of Coen's movies, you just have such a like preternatural sense of what that's going to feel like.
Oh yeah.
Not necessarily what it's going to look like, but what it's going to feel like.
And sound like.
And so my idea, my prismtation this week is when you see something you can barely see, episode 6.
That's in reference to them looking, not being able to see what they're firing at.
Yeah.
As simple as that. Yeah.
Or that glint.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you see the glint, but you don't necessarily see what's even reflecting the light.
Yeah, or you're able to see pieces of something, but within the scene, there's a fragment.
Yeah.
You try to decipher what the fragment is, and then more information comes through.
Yeah. So the first clip I chose is from The Big Lebowski. It's when the dude enters Maude Lebowski's art studio. It's a lot of POV shots where you sort of see what he sees of this like paint-spattered floor, and then we see a canvas, and he hears this odd music, and then all of a sudden he hears something behind him and he's kind of like almost like ambushed like from overhead, and you don't even really know what he sees, but he sees something crazy coming towards him. And then it's Maude on this zip line painting rig. She flies over him and spatters paint all over this canvas, which is the female, she says is the female form, but it's also like clearly referenced to like Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, like the famous Da Vinci with the arms, you know, the arms and the legs.
In a circle. Yeah.
I'm going to pretend like I know what you're talking about.
It's like it's the image they put on the satellite of a guy in a circle, and he's got his arms like this. And he's got
right. Yeah.
He's kind of like flapping his wings almost.
It's like Renaissance high-tech anatomy.
Is that the thing that people draw like Fibonacci's on?
Yeah.
That? Okay.
And like this, the like spiral.
I'm just going to look at
what
it.
What does it like go into his dick or something? Like, where does it end up?
It's called Da Vinci. What?
Just do like Da Vinci arm legs.
Yeah, people are. It's like conspiracy theories.
Oh, that's interesting.
Fibonacci's, golden ratio. Yeah.
Mm. I'm just interested in like how this sort of like micro sequence works visually and builds tension and presents the main character with this sort of like complex, subtle, yet high tension, like visual and auditory experience that kind of like.
Well, this is her intro, right?
It's her first full frontal and back frontal.
It's her and her element, I guess, yeah.
But he does like earlier in the movie, I think he wakes up and we see her for a second, and then he like wakes up on the floor and then he gets punched, and then like he sees the back of her head on like the magic carpet. But this is the first time we like know who she is.
Okay, so she's been teased like twice, and now we're finally getting to meet her.
Which could be another example of seeing something that you can barely see.
Yeah, I miss Julianne Moore doing parts like this. She had a really creative streak.
This is in the like Hannibal era, kind of, or is that it's later than that, Xander?
Well, she was in Boogie Nights a little before that, and then Magnolia,
right?
Like her
Far From Heaven.
Far From Heaven.
Yeah.
The Hours, right? Is she in that?
She's definitely in The Hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Y2K was a great era for Julianne.
Yeah. Hannibal,
She's so self-possessed. I mean, she's almost, her character's almost doing, in the clip I included a little bit of her dialogue too. And we heard her on the phone also earlier, but just the voice she's doing, doesn't it kind of remind you of Jennifer Jason Leigh in Hudsucker also
totally.
A little bit?
They kind of had the same haircut, actually. But okay, also, so she's been teased twice already, and we're finally getting, he just approaches her down this long, dark tunnel room space towards this mystery at the end. The scene begins with these like reflections of like spattered paint. He's entering this kind of dream space with this strange noise. It's like more mystery, like what's happening? I don't know. It's like a vaginal space, right?
They pretty much make that explicit.
I feel like so, right? About. Isn't that like what's going on here?
Yeah. Man walks down long hallway.
Which then just makes me think of the, it makes me think of the ear canal at the beginning of Serious Man.
Oh, yeah.
Or the pipe in Barton Fink.
I think about the pipe shot in Barton Fink all the time.
What's the main thing you think about it?
Well, that they wrote it and Roger Deakins is like, how do I do this? And they're just like, you'll figure it out. And then it was amazing.
Isn't there a quote from him on his podcast where he's like, then when the Coens called me up to do like the next one, I was like, you're not going to be having me put the camera down any more drain holes, are you?
I mean, their match made in heaven. I think it's perfect. Perfect match.
And what do you think rubs off from him on them the most?
It's so subtle.
Yeah.
Basically just like how, but it's so, I think his stuff, he understands comedy, I think. Mm-hmm. Whereas like, watching Burn After Reading, it was cool to watch, but like, it's a little like moody, the cinematography. And, you know, Bruno's stuff is really moody too, but his stuff is almost like too stylized for me. Like just he's into this weird like smeariness of like the light. And
a lot of a lot of filtering. Yeah.
Yeah. You could tell he has this weird kind of like he refuses to look at an image without that on it. And I think Deakins is a little bit more flexible, but his lighting is just great. And
you don't think they pushed him on Scruggs though, Bruno?
Oh, for sure. They did. Yeah. Like rewatching Lewin, I was like, I kind of wish like it looks great. When I watched it, I was like, I love that they have a new DP. Rewatching it, I'm just like, there's something about it that's a little too much. The filtration and the color palette. But I actually really like Bruno's work on Harry Potter 6, the Half-Blood Prince. I used to want to be a cinematographer, actually. So I get heavy into DPs. But yeah, I thought Buster Scruggs looks great.
Yeah, and he doesn't have glass in front of the lens on some of those shorts. I don't know about all of them.
I have a question just on a purely cinematography level. Those kind of Gaussian blurs that are so dominant in Lewin Davis.
Yeah.
Is that something that's happening in camera? That's happening, is they're doing that?
I'm sure it's in camera. Yeah. It's partially in camera.
Yeah. That's like a ProMist or whatever.
Didn't it look mildly digital to you though?
It's shot digitally, yeah.
No. Lewin Davis is shot on film.
Oh really?
But
okay.
For some reason looks kind of digital, I would say.
You know, Deakins did I remember he was like one of the first to do a DI on O Brother, Where Art Thou? And that has kind of like a weird effect to it too.
It's early in terms of like how much they push it, like scene to scene, like how amber they have things look. Like there's a little bit of a sheen on it that maybe when you watch it now, you're like, why is that like all green or all orange? Mm-hmm.
I also think like the Coens were, you know, in their first two movies, they're like in love with the wide lens. And Deakins is in love with the long lens. And I think they have a good battle between what lens to use that I think ends up being the right choice all the time. Whereas like I honestly don't think Raising Arizona looks very great. I think it's an awesome movie. And I think Blood Simple is an awesome movie, but Miller's Crossing.
I think they're too wide.
There's just something about the way they look that's lax. Like, I don't know. There's less dimension to it. There's less of a...
like the dignity of the human face or something.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Deakins, like Barton Fink is just night and day with Miller's Crossing, you know, with the way they look.
I saw this when it came out in theaters. I was pretty young.
Which one?
Lebowski.
Lebowski. Oh, wow. Yeah I didn't. This was definitely a DVD. Yo, you got to watch this. I think this might have been one of the first ones. I got into movies in like high school. So I was pretty late in that world. And it was one of the first ones I was like, oh, you got to watch this. And didn't connect with it the first time I watched it. Didn't connect with Fargo either. All these movies I got into in college. Like, I basically was watching them with new eyes.
Can you describe the first experience when you didn't connect with them?
I just thought it was kind of boring. And I mean, I definitely remember Fargo, thinking Fargo was boring. And then every single time I've watched Fargo, I find it to be funnier and funnier. And I'm just like blown away how funny and amazing it is. And Lebowski, the same. It gets better every single time I watch it. I don't know. I mean, I feel like what I was looking for in movies was probably more, it's like a drunk person. Like, you want something that's really, like, McDonald's tastes amazing to a drunk person because it's so over the top and it's just attacking your senses. And I wanted some, like, you know, I liked Clockwork Orange. I thought that was, you know, my idea of a perfect movie when I'm like in high school. So I'm like, I wanted something that was just kind of hitting you over the head with what it meant. Not, you know. And I think Kubrick has done some subtle, you know, Barry Lyndon's a subtle movie. So yeah, the Coens, those movies weren't really working for me. Barton Fink was the first one that worked for me because I was like, I'm Barton Fink. This is me. And I tell you, right, as I watch it over and over again, I'm like, this guy is horrible. I hate him.
Yeah,
I hate that I even connected with him. And I hate myself. Yeah.
Yeah, this is me, and I'm now going to go through a painful period of personal development.
Exactly. I'll tell you, but the life of the mind.
When I saw your feature for the first time, I think at the Quad.
It was a Cinema Village.
Oh, Cinema
beautiful,
Village.
Beautiful Cinema Village, yeah.
Yeah.
I wish it was the Quad. That would have been cool.
We could just say I was at the Quad. And I saw the scene where, like, I didn't make the Llewyn Davis connection, which now that I watched it, like, I feel like, Ray, you kind of tipped me off to that a little bit. But, and we'll get to Llewyn. We could talk about it there. But when I just saw the scene of him sitting down with Al, I was like, this guy likes Coens, and he's fucking doing Coens in a way that...
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're definitely thinking about the lens choice, for sure. Is it on the 28 millimeter? Is it on the 35 millimeter?
This is like a desk scene. Like, Coen brothers films are famous for, like, guy behind the desk scenes.
Oh, yeah.
And this is, like, a solid...
Barton Fink desk scene. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that desk... Very little production design on that desk in Army of Cats.
That's just, like, what was going on in that guy's office?
Yeah, that desk just existed. Yeah, it was like a sign factory that we kind of was changing hands, and we were able to get in there and, like, basically take it over for like a month and a half for, you know, 10 grand, which was the most money we spent on the entire movie. And yeah, that office looked amazing. Just sort of shifted a couple of things around, and there we go.
Why is that coverage funny?
In that scene?
Just in all, like, why is that kind of coverage of an over-the-desk conversation is kind of always kind of funny, right?
Yeah. I guess it's like it's an absurd scenario. It's, two people that are not very similar. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a much better answer, is like the actual, like, character dynamics. Like, my answer was just that you get to put a bunch of funny stuff in the background.
That too, yeah.
You're saying
prop comedy.
It's like prop comedy. It's the switching between one face and another face that's different is what's essentially funny about it. And then there's more space to put more jokes in the frame.
Yeah.
That's why.
And also, like, the fact that, like, you and Deakins both don't do over the shoulder in those sequences. So it's like,
I don't like over the shoulder that much.
Yeah. It's like tableau, 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 tableau. Like, it's like, there's something, like, very, like, open. Like, there's, like, a ability
I like dirty, like, dirty frames, but I don't like a traditional, like, over the shoulder.
Maybe something too, where it's like, if the frame is totally cluttered and the person's in the center of it and they're looking at you, all these other objects in the frame are kind of competing for your attention and telling you other things about them, and they're just kind of tunnel vision, ignoring everything around them. That's kind of funny. There's some kind of, like, people look a little daft in these frames, right? There's, like, there's something about it where it makes, like, the essential interaction of an interview with someone who's in power.
Yeah,
I don't know.
He's taking an interest in you. I just rewatched that actually, like, a couple of days ago. Just that scene.
He's taken an interest. It's like the scariest thing that could possibly happen. Yeah. So watching Lebowski in theaters, I do remember that sequence being scary. The shot of her flying towards camera and him looking back and seeing her. I mean, it's shot a little bit like a horror movie sequence.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you're not sure whether it's blood or not. This is a film that goes back and forth between violent scenes and comedy scenes, so you're not sure which one you're walking into.
Yeah.
Or, like, hangout scenes and kind of, like, genre scenes, and this is a hangout scene.
And that, like, the breathy, like, music that's playing in the background.
Yeah, I was rewatching this movie and forgot that it took place during... Because now I've been really considering, like, what time everything is set in. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to Ray, I was like, oh... Are any of the Coen movies, like, just, like, flat out contemporary? Just, we're not even going to talk about what time it is because the time is now. I think only Burn After Reading.
Burn After Reading. Yeah. And what about Blood Simple?
Blood Simple, probably, yeah.
Yeah.
But what about Lady Killers?
I would have to rewatch.
Yeah,
or
Lady
Intolerable
Killers.
Cruelty?
Lady Killers and Intolerable Cruelty, probably both.
But yeah, I thought it was an interesting choice that Lebowski is like 91, right?
Yeah, 91 for a movie that was shot in like 96.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like us setting a movie in 2013.
Yeah.
I saw Lebowski at like a preview screening in high school in Manhattan, and I was such a big Fargo fan. I'd like gone all in on Fargo. And so I was like, before it's out, I want to see it. And I definitely remember already felt like a really long time ago, like the whole mental cloud of the Desert Storm war, right? And the whole kind of cultural...
You're in like impeachment zone, right?
Exactly. It seems so long
Monica
ago.
Lewinsky, yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like how the Bush era felt in like 2009.
Exactly. At least in my memory, that's very much the way it played in real time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, because that was like a bit of a recession too, right? That's why sort of Bill Clinton won. People were not feeling so great about...
So maybe it's like, it's the last moment where you can set this film where like Republican squares, like the president that you see on TV kind of has the same energy that the Big Lebowski does. You know, when you see...
Mm. Well, that was sort of a new era too, the neoliberal kind of third way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know,
I think maybe like also like they saw the slacker archetype like showing up in movies, and they were like, well, if you were going to do this for real, it would have to be like 1992.
Because like 92 is the year that all that stuff kind of becomes mainstream. So it's like, this is the last time when you can show a character who's just hanging on from the 60s.
Yeah. Because also like, after, yeah, 90, you know, 2, 93, or when is like a grunge at its like peak? Slacker vibe at its peak, 93, right?
Yeah, 93, 94.
Yeah, like Nevermind comes out in 92. Yeah. Bill Clinton gets, you know, the presidency in 92. It's like a big kind of end of one era, beginning of another.
I feel like for me, like as a very young kid, by the time I heard Nirvana, Kurt Cobain was already dead.
And everyone was skating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's just like as like a little baby, basically. Let's switch gears to the second clip. No Country.
No Country. Oh,
yeah.
It's terrifying. Amazing clip.
Yeah. Powerhouse sequence.
Yeah.
It's where Ed Tom Bell returns to the motel where Llewellyn was killed, sort of on a hunch that there's something there that he missed. Like, he gets out of his car. He approaches the door. He's kind of illuminated by the headlights of his car. He pauses at the door, looks into the hole where the door's lock has been blown out. He, like, peers at it. And then we cut and we see Anton Sugar on the other side. And terrifying. he looks through and he can actually see this glint, which is, I think, the first thing I thought of when I read that line was like the reflection in the metal of the hole that's been blown out.
Mm-hmm.
And we get just filled with absolute terror because we're like, this movie's already killed off Josh Brolin. What's going to happen when Tommy Lee Jones goes into this hotel room? He goes in, looks around. Nobody's in there. He looks in the bathroom. He sees the windows locked. There's like a really beautiful little insert of the locked window lock, goes back into the main room, sits down on the bed. He sees the coin and the heating vent, and that's it. And we're just left thinking, where the fuck did he go? I mean, that's like the main thing that you're thinking, right?
Yeah. And then he just like, there's this weird unresolved anxiety and dread from that scene. You're just like, Anton Chigurh, you're something else.
He's supernatural and yet not.
Yeah. Like, beautiful shot of him too. Amazing shot.
Yeah, the like glistening little teardrop.
Did you guys read the shooting pages for this scene?
No.
Okay, so in the pages they go into such description of the... Can I just read this to you guys?
Yes.
The curved brass of its hollow interior holds a reflection of the motel room exterior. Lights and shapes. The curvature distorts to unrecognizability when it is reflected. But we see the color of Sheriff Bell's uniform. The reflection is very still, then slow movement. He nudges the door inward. As the lock cylinder slowly recedes, reflected shapes scramble inside it and slide up its curve. Anyway, I read that just to say they went into great... the way that all those... How would you describe that? There's the lock that's been punched out, and the interior of it is brass, and it's these incredibly detailed. It's so clearly described as a big event in the script pages. This lighting effect that's going to occur when there's like a cylinder that's reflective and the light is bouncing around inside of it and the door is moving.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how much detail they put in because it's no accident why it looks so expressive.
And the scene hinges on the fact, because of the lighting differences of the interior and the exterior, Sugar can see Tommy Lee Jones moving around in that reflection, and Tommy Lee Jones can't see Anton Sugar.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I never put that together. So that's a mirror, basically, that Sugar is looking at him as he's approaching.
Oh, okay.
Like, just barely. He can see that there's a guy out there.
What character do you relate to the most in this movie? in No Country?
Probably Llewellyn, just because
yeah,
he thinks he's got it together. And also, I think we've probably talked about this before, that like the main character of a movie showing off their skills, you generally expect that they're like, they're going to fuck up a little bit, but they're not going to like completely blow it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a cool like false protagonist. I've heard people say, oh, I want to play like a Josh Brolin in No Country. I'm like, oh, interesting. You know, because it's a lead, but it's, you know, it's.
You want to get your ass not, blown away.
Yeah. Not for real, for real.
Does that character have like a beginning and a middle and an end, or does he get cut off like through his halfway through his arc?
If you think about him getting fucked up outside the hotel and then like waking up in a hospital and like retrieving the money, there's definitely like a solid beat sheet for that guy. But, you know, I don't know that many movies where somebody gets taken out that way, especially the way that they cut to Tommy Lee Jones POV and you just see him like fucking laid out, like the POV switch to see the main character dead, mm-hmm. like so clearly from someone else's perspective, does feel like a rupture of like what you'd expect.
I wonder if they wrote that script themselves versus adapting it from a book, would it be harder to sell that to a studio to get a finance? Because it's like, well, it happens in the book, you know. I'm sure Hollywood's like, well, could we change the book a little bit? Like, have you seen the remake of The Vanishing, the American remake of Vanishing?
Oh, yeah.
They changed
by the same ending. Director. Me and Jordan studied this in college. We took a class that was all about directors remaking their own films.
Oh, nice.
And that was one of the films that we watched. Yeah. No, I mean, this is one of the best rewrites ever. The European film ends with a guy buried alive.
Yeah,
dying incredible. In a grave underground. The American remake.
Terrifying.
He busts his way out of the grave and comes. He like, it's Jeff Bridges, right? He like,
yeah.
He comes out of the ground like a worm and like saves the day at the end.
It's a wonderful life.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
It's click. Yeah. We were talking about the false protagonist thing. Like if it wasn't in the book, it seems like it's a tough sell to switch up your protagonist, unless, you know, you're, especially for a drama.
Well, so much of this movie is just about like from the very beginning, just like tracking Llewellyn and just seeing, is he going to survive? Is he going to be able to navigate this moment to suddenly like have the moment where he finally eats it to happen off screen? Just feels so counter to like the way you've been trained to watch the movie so far. If you're rooted with one person, it's really with him, and he just leaves before you have a chance to really say goodbye.
It's sad. I mean, it feels sad in a way that like actual death feels. Again, maybe it's a reach, but there's something about it where you feel like wrenched by it.
There's a level of cruelty to that death that is like kind of outside of the way narrative usually works.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah, that is the point, maybe.
That's part of what makes this sequence we're talking about so fucking terrifying, is like now we're on to this like older man. Is he going to take on Anton Chigurh if he comes face to face with him?
Yeah, and yeah, we don't get much closure in this scene.
Yeah.
What do the double shadows make you guys think about when you see them?
For some reason, they make me think of a cowboy movie, but I don't know why. Like, I don't know if there's a specific cowboy movie where you see the double shadows, but just something about the silhouette, like, feels a little bit like Searchers. What about you, Xander?
It's just like, it reminds me of your eyes playing tricks on you, or if, like, imagine if someone's walking with your double shadow at the same time. Just mimicking it. Like, you know, he's being watched.
It's an optical trick. Like, this scene is like playing up optical tricks. Like, there's like the flicker of the headlights. Yeah, like the double shadow, which is like isn't that the whole point of like soft lighting, is that you don't ever want to have a double shadow?
Makes sense. I mean, I understand, Xander, what you're saying. There's something about the dynamic between him looking at that silhouette deeper in the room as he's in the doorway of the room. It almost gives you the feeling that maybe someone's watching him from behind, you know.
Yeah, but it's just this double shadow.
Yeah, there's this real sense, and that shadow, the more I look at it, the shape is like a three-armed cowboy. It's so surreal, and just like, just in its own way, it's normal, but it's not. It's really this odd kind of alien figure.
Yeah,
because of the doubling, I mean, he thinks maybe someone's in there, and so that shadow is kind of like a figure that he's targeting on as he's standing in the door. But I don't know. It's like a ghost or something that appears. But it's also so, I mean, it looks a lot like the illustration that's at the beginning of the Buster Scruggs chapter, where it's that shot, like literally just like from the hip with the gun coming into the frame, hanging down.
Yeah. And also the shadow. And are you talking about All Gold Canyon?
I'm talking about like literally the Buster Scruggs, where it's like shot the from one. Behind the guy as he's holding a gun at the poker table, which is like similarly kind of just like, it's like, it's, you know, it's a cowboy with like a gun drawn at his side.
But it does remind me also of the way that the shadow kind of tips him off.
Totally.
Yeah.
Tom Waits. The shadow of the owl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely creates like a sense of paranoia and not trusting your own eyes.
Yeah, to me, the two lighting events in the scene that are the kind of the trippiest are like all those, the scrambling reflected shapes inside the cylinder. You know, that's like a big firework event to me visually, and the double shadows are like just big, big firework events. So like the scene is set in a normal world, but there's just these parts that are just so surreal looking.
We said he goes back on a hunch, he said. That was your description of it, Jordan, right?
Yeah.
He goes back on a hunch, and then he sees a bunch, you know, he basically trips out, sees a bunch of shadows, sees things, and literally we know he's there, and then, he leaves.
He leaves, yes. I think he's terrifying. There's people online who say that he was hiding under the bed. I think he just was behind the door, and then when he goes in the bathroom, he slipped out.
The dude just can control his breath really well or something. He's a supernatural, you know, being.
Yeah, I mean, we see him move so silently in other scenes.
I wonder how long he could hold his breath underwater. Anton.
Can you imagine Javier Bardem as an Avatar?
Yeah, I think he would fit in great.
Avatar 5.
Yeah.
So next up is the scene in A Serious Man where Arthur Gopnik climbs up to his roof to fix the aerial, kind of clanks the ladder against the roof of his, the ladder like comes into frame in a very beautiful shot of the sky. He's going up to fix the aerial, which his son has been asking him about. He says like, F troop's fuzzy, you need to fix the aerial. And then he looks around. The music is so good in this scene.
This scene gives me chills. It's incredible.
He looks around, he sees a car going to the right. The camera kind of follows the car to the right, and then kids on their bikes are going to their left, so then it kind of drifts over to the left.
Gets a beautiful bird's eye view of suburbia.
His whole neighborhood, ghetto.
It's the Jewish ghetto. My cousins live in like a suburban neighborhood in Arizona. It's all Jews and like two blocks. Like it's like, you know, and they're from old country. So they can
Are they modern Orthodox?
Serious Man's not modern Orthodox. It's it's conservative. My entire family is conservative, Jewish conservative. That's why I connect with this movie so much.
Yeah.
You could continue, but it's like, it's emblematic of the American conservative Jewish movement.
Yeah, no, like the fact that they're in Hebrew school learning about how they're going to plant a tree in Israel is not just like, that's not Reform, that's not Orthodox. That's like the fact that the girls.
I went to Jewish day school. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same here. Elementary. Yeah. And then I went to Hebrew school for middle school when I went to a public middle and public high school. And then I was confirmed, which is a conservative thing. It doesn't make any sense, really.
Huh.
I got bar mitzvah, and then I did, continued work. They showed me, we had to watch Schindler's List over and over again, which I never liked, by the way, in middle school. Now, I mean, I was describing why I was never into Spielberg. It's because of Hebrew school. And then that's why I was like a Kubrick guy. But now I'm into Spielberg. I'm a Spielberg guy now.
He's a Spielberg boy.
I finally saw the light.
So he looks over to his next door neighbors on the right side of his house, and he sees his neighbor, the like gruff middle-aged guy, veteran, probably veteran of the Korean War, or maybe veteran of World War II, playing catch with his son in this like really aggressive way. Like it's very like it's the sound of punching, the way that
I love that character.
The catch.
Is this man bothering you?
Yeah. You see like the racial hierarchy there? It's like this guy's anti-Semitic, but also he's going to defend his Jewish neighbor from the Korean guy who showed up.
So I guess it isn't the ghetto. He has a Christian neighbor.
The camera kind of like drifts over and from this like aggressive game of catch, and Gopnik touches the aerial, the antenna, and he hears these faint radio broadcasts of these different programs like reverberating in his head. The theme of the episode is when you see something you can barely see, but it's also when you hear something you can barely hear. This sort of ethereal moment of like, it's like it's both like spiritual but also super modern, the way that he hears these broadcasts.
Yeah, with the score,
Yeah. And then he looks over and he sees his neighbor, Ms. Vivian Samsky. She's sunbathing nude, and she like sort of like lazily picks up a joint and takes a drag, and we hear this like sultry flute melody.
Coming back to me.
Yeah.
Whenever I smoke weed, I want it to feel like the beginning of that song. Yeah. just like I imagine like having like, you know, the window open. Beginning of that, the flute, Jefferson Airplane. Yeah,
this is your aspirational weed smoking movie.
Ray asked me what instrument is that, and like the best I could come up with is it's the flute. that Bill plays in Kill Bill? What do you know what instrument that is?
I mean, I'm pretty sure it's just a flute, right?
It's so bassy though. It's a deep flute.
So earthy.
And then the end of this sequence is he looks off in the distance and then the camera pans directly into the sun. And I just wanted to ask you guys, like, I watched this movie for like probably 4 or 5 times and I thought he passed out at the end of that scene.
Me too.
And I only recently like reread it, like reinterpreted that scene where I'm like, you don't actually see him pass out. And I don't think it's meant to be that he passed out.
Seems like he got too much sun.
Yeah.
Like, honestly.
So I just looked up that song. I don't know if it says if there's a flute in it, but it just says it was written by Marty Balin. Marty Balin recalls that the song was created while he indulged in some primo grade marijuana given to him by blues singer Paul Butterfield. After writing the song in one sitting, he immediately went to the studio to record his composition. Yeah, so.
Well, that's beautiful original research. Thank you.
Wait, he smoked weed, wrote the song, and then immediately went to the studio, like in a matter of like an hour and a half?
Yeah, he wrote the song in one sitting and immediately went to the studio to record his composition without any available musicians at the studio.
That's so awesome.
Really efficient afternoon, yeah.
Hell yeah. Yeah. He's a productive smoker.
Primo. So I imagine it's like the, you know, sativa, crazy sativa. Yeah. I'm not a big weed smoker, but when I do, I like to think of this song.
Doesn't this feel similar to the way they shot the... Julianne Moore being
Yeah, naked? It's a similar presentation of these like very powerful, very sexy women from far away, very much in control of their kind of general, the kind of space and the tone around them.
Yeah, I love this character.
Yeah.
And then the other scenes with her, yeah.
She's like redefined. Like
she knows what she wants, yeah.
She's like recontextualized the white picket fence to be like for a like hot divorcee.
Well, yeah, I just love that. Like in suburban environments, there's no mountain, there's no hill, there's just your roof.
Very flat part of the world.
Yeah, and you know this character never feels big. He's always being belittled, and he finally has like a moment where he gets to see the big picture for a second.
He like literally gets too close to the sun when he does that too.
In real life, when you're adjusting an antenna like that in the 60s, you're not hearing the sounds. Like that's the part of it that's like, what do you call it? Well, like stylized.
Well, here's the interesting thing is like, I didn't do like preparatory research, but I do know that if you have like a certain dental filling or like a plate in your head or something like that, there are like stories that I think are not entirely made up.
Well, you might feel some kind of like magnetic or, you might feel some sort of tingling or something, right?
Or you can hear a little bit of a radio broadcast in your head because you're...
That's terrifying.
The metal in your head is...
That's why you need your tinfoil hat. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think this, like, relates... Like, in a very, like, oblique way, I feel like this relates to the dentist story. Just because, like, I associate this... Because I associate this with dentistry. Like, this phenomenon of, like, being able to hear... Like
and
when
yeah,
I...
this movie has a lot to do with dentistry. Yeah.
Yeah.
The goy's teeth.
Yeah. Powerhouse sequence. Something I didn't say in the last episode four is we talked about the opener of Raising Arizona, and I was like, they never did another opener like this. But yeah. I feel like the goy's teeth is like the closest they've come to going back to that
just
style.
Like, just narrative progression.
Right, yeah, right.
Just like powerful images one after another.
I would say the last thing is, the movie made me feel seen. I saw it actually, I think, 3 times. I was in college at this time, and the movies would end up going to the cinema on the student life cinema on campus. Like basically it was like a second run kind of. So I saw it there, but to see a movie twice in theaters was a big deal for me. I just would never do that. But I finally got my parents to watch it and they hated it. And that's what blew my mind. They were just like, he's such a pushover. Why would he do that?
They didn't, they didn't have the reaction of like, look at this beautiful spread of kosher food that
the
Coens made for me. Like they didn't feel represented.
They actively disliked it. They're just like, you know, yeah, it was cool that, you know, it was Jewish and that kid was bar mitzvah, but they're like, why was this main character such a pushover? They didn't like that.
That's really interesting.
Did they see Uncut Gems?
They liked Uncut Gems. Yeah. They probably thought Uncut Gems was a little, you know, a little anxiety inducing, you know, the classic response, but I think they liked it.
They related, but they related more to like the Passover scene in Uncut Gems.
And they saw, I remember they watched that movie Menashe, and my dad was like, the Yiddish in that movie is very crude compared to, because my dad's first language is Yiddish.
Actually. Oh.
So he's Esau, yeah. He's a Yiddish speaker first. So him and their whole family, they spoke Yiddish to each other. My mom never learned, doesn't know Yiddish, though. Yeah. So I never learned it because they didn't speak it to each other. Something I you know, wish was different.
Because you guys, you seem to know so specifically like what...
The different denominations are.
Exactly. What am I missing or what am I not, what is not factoring into my understanding of the story, not knowing that stuff, like knowing where Larry specifically comes from and the community that he's in.
Honestly, not much.
I'm just saying like context about this community that they're in, like what they're doing at that moment in that year in America. Like what is he, what's he a part of?
Yeah, I just think it's like, it's how specific the world is and, you know, the rabbis as like these sort of, you know, village therapists and mediators and, you know, rabbis doing like house calls and things like that. I think it's, I mean, seeing any community that you don't know anything about, it's just nice that there's like a specificity. I'm always bad at saying that word. It's a word I like to say all the time. It doesn't really matter if you don't know it. It's just amazing how that it's real. There was a big push, I think, in the 60s for this conservative movement of Judaism, where it was like, okay, we're in America. We're here. The Holocaust is over. There's a women's movement. We want, you know, women to be empowered. We want them, they could be rabbis, and they, you know, they could ask for divorces, ritual divorces, a get. So I guess it kind of all collides with, you know, the 60s feminism, the end
so
of the war.
So a get is a relatively new concept at this point?
No.
Well, get, it's like a weird thing because it's like a ritual divorce, but they're still holding on to it that you need it.
That the men have to be the one to allow the woman, like her freedom. It's still like something that the husband has to sign ritually. So it's like a very backward anti-feminist tradition, but they're kind of wielding it in the story as like this sort of power play by the wife and her.
Yeah, and they're all practicing this sort of progressive form of Judaism for the time. It's just incredibly well researched, and I'm sure this was very similar to their upbringing in Minnesota. And yeah, it feels very personal. It's reflective of the time that they're in. Yeah, the 60s. Yeah, you don't really need to know any of this stuff. You're not missing anything. It's just texture. But I think texture is what I respond to in their movies the most.
I mean, like a lot of the time, I think when going through these different scripts, like they'll always like pick a moment in time, but it's like the end of what, it's like, this is the week before Bob Dylan plays the nightclub, or this is like the last moment in 91 before the boomers take over the country and they feel like losers still. But it's like always that like transition and this like just understanding that like, yeah, the dynamics between him and all the people in his community are shifting because their ideas are changing.
Yeah. Yeah. Great scene. Great movie. This is definitely my favorite Coen Brothers movie.
Are you going New York?
Man, that's great. I'm going home to New Jersey. I've not slept. You drive, right?
Yeah.
Well, as long as you drive and let me sleep, we can do it all the way, man.
The big scene for me is the hitchhiking scene, but I surrounded it with some other scenes. They all feed into it. So, first up, it's just the scene where Lewin takes the cat on the subway train and he sees this businessman, gives him this like weird look. This guy with a mustache, very like recognizable, kind of paunchy dude. And the cat looks out at the subway window and he looks at all the mosaics of the street names. You see the cat's little kitty face. Like, I feel like as a cat owner, like my brain has been completely changed in terms of like how these scenes play to me. But like you see the mosaics of the streets of the street names, like the station names flying by, of the subway stops.
I love that, the sound design of that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. The like clatter, and then and you see the cat's face reflected. The cat tries to escape, and then Lewin grabs him. Next scene is just a tiny little clip, but I wanted to include it where Lewin's alone on the subway with the cat, and the same businessman that he saw earlier stares him down. In the script pages, the Coens say, like, is it the same businessman? Like, they write it as a question, which to me feels, like, very, like, evocative of, like, how they think of these types of little details.
Yeah, it's amazing they write in the script that they're not sure. Because, like, most, you know, an executive would be like, but, like, tell me, like, is it or is it not? And they're just like, I mean, they're not sure themselves. Yeah.
And it was like, we're going to cast the same guy and you're fired. That's how I would handle it.
Accept the mystery.
Yeah. Accept the mystery. Yeah, exactly. And then the sort of big sequence that we're going to talk about is Lewin hitchhiking. And then we see him driving the car. He listens to the Quack Quack novelty song on the radio, which I feel like is like an important detail. Like it ties into the song that he recorded earlier.
Mm-hmm.
He sees the sign for Akron, Ohio fly by. Those shots are so similar to the way the mosaics look when they fly by. Just the way the camera like follows it. And then he sees Akron shining in the distance, which is like just a godly moment of like the city lights in the distance. And then the exit sign flies by. So he kind of decides he's not going to get off. He switches the station to Opera. He drives through the darkness and snow's falling. And then all of a sudden he gasps and sees something and slams on the brakes. And we barely see a cat like right at the last minute. Gets out. He sees blood on the bumper. And then he looks and he can just barely make out in the distance this poor little cat limping into the woods beside the highway. Then he gets back in the car and drives off. And then the last little piece I included is him walking down the street. He walks by the movie theater, sees the poster for the movie. And the only thing I wanted to include in that scene is the guy a few steps ahead of him, the same businessman that he saw? Because that's not in the script, but I feel like they included that actor on the street.
Did you look
when
at this scene?
When he looks at the poster?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I rewatched this and I saw your question in the email. I have no idea. I mean,
if it's not the same actor, it's a doppelganger, right?
Yeah, I'm sure they do that on purpose. But why, I guess, is a good question.
I think it's just giving you that sort of like sense memory of the same like.
Well, because it's not the same cat. And then maybe that has to do with it. Like, he loses the cat and he finds the wrong cat.
Yeah.
And you think it's the same businessman, but maybe it's not. Like, everything looks the same to him.
Right, he saw that cat on the street.
He gets a cat that's not Ulysses and brings it to Ohio with him.
Well, this whole movie is just basically about like timing and happenstance and the randomness of life. And he could have been Bob Dylan. He could have, yeah.
Yeah, it's about him being replaced. Yeah, that's interesting too. Like the whole movie ends with him, another guy getting up on stage and singing a song that also goes fairly well. Oh man, I hadn't even made that. That's better than anything I could have come up with.
Did the movie ends with him basically being walked off stage and being replaced?
And being replaced, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's like another universe where maybe it could have happened, but then it also didn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the circular nature of this movie. I saw this movie for the first time in the Union Square Regal, RIP. I don't know if it's closed yet, but
it's
coming.
Yeah.
Is it closing? Really?
Yeah.
I think I saw it on the second floor of it, too. Like, it was
that
like
big
huge,
room with the mezzanine? That's room. Amazing.
Yeah.
I saw it there, too, actually.
Packed. It was like opening night, yeah.
That's a gigantic screen to watch this movie on.
Oh, yeah. And it was very special.
But can we talk about, like, just, like, the way that hitchhiking scene functions in terms of just, like, you're driving through the dark, and all you can see is kind of, like, the snow on the headlights, and you've got this stranger sleeping next to you. Just that mood on its own. It just feels so lonely and so like dreamy.
Yeah, I love the whole road trip sequence in this movie, and I have no like takeaway for it. It's just sort of, you know, this guy is like being confronted with the collective choices he's made in life, and that he's wound up on the road with these strange people.
And also he's going to audition.
Yeah.
Like it's really like, as much as he's burned out throughout the story and everything, it's like his big play is, I don't have anywhere to stay in New York City. Like, I don't have a place to sleep in New York, but I can just go to Chicago to see Bud Grossman directly. It's almost, I don't even think he really tells anyone that that's his plan. Maybe that would reveal that he wanted it a little bit too much.
Yeah. I think the first time we like get the sense of what he's even doing is like when he's already all the way there at like the diner and he looks at the phone book and you see Knight of Horn or Horn of Plenty or whatever it's called.
Gate of Horn.
I love what a miserable prick he is in this movie. That's all I got to say.
Well,
because if he wasn't so miserable, you know, I do wonder, like, you know, if he wasn't so miserable, maybe he would have gotten there.
Here's like the way that my perception of this movie flipped a little bit. Like the last time we recorded, I haven't rewatched it since then, other than this scene. But I basically said this is like the most miserable movie that they've ever made. Like, it's like,
it's funny though.
It's funny, but also I feel like they're making a point about how separate and essential his just playing and singing is, like his performance and the music that he's bringing into the world compared to how people are responding to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that that's kind of the magic trick of this movie is that
that the music is actually pretty good and they're able to like Because it's hard, you know, movies are always struggling when they show a character doing any type of creative work and people's response to it. And you want to make sure that the creative work is actually good if the response is that it's good. But it's funny that the creative work is actually good, but the response is negative. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing worse than a scene in a movie where someone performs mediocre, like singing or comedy, and then the audience response is just like flatly not how you feel.
Yeah. I thought A Star Is Born actually did a good job, you know, having some good music and the reaction being that this person's a star.
Absolutely.
The Cooper one.
Well, I feel like this one, when I was watching the F. Murray Abraham Gate of Horn scene, the way the shots are moving and the way it's cutting back and forth, the look on F. Murray Abraham's face at the end of it and the way that Oscar Isaac stops playing guitar and just sings the last verse of it, it's so faking you out. You're imprinting on F. Murray Abraham's face that he's being blown away by this performance up until the moment he says, I don't see a lot of money here.
Yeah.
And then later when they start talking about Troy right after that, and he's like, Troy really connects with people. You know, and it's like
it's an amazing magic trick, because it's like the movie wouldn't have worked at all if Oscar Isaac couldn't hack it.
Yeah.
If the music was even like just, you know, almost, you know, it's almost good. You know, like it, and I guess maybe it's, you could argue, I'm sure there's a lot of people that watch this movie and they're like, I don't like folk music, so I don't care. But you could still sort of, I feel like it's objectively like pretty good at the very least.
Yeah. It's like it brings up the difference between are you good artist? Or are you actually in dialogue with the people around you? Because there's all these moments where it's like people offer him, like, do you want to join Peter, Paul, and Mary? Like, do you?
Yeah. Peter Yarrow came to my summer camp, Jewish summer camp. Yeah. And played Puff the Magic Dragon.
What was he like?
It feels like a dream to me. I feel like maybe it didn't even happen because I was like, 12 years old or something, learning how to shoot rifles.
Yeah, so but like
they're training the Jews to shoot rifles. You know, you never know when they might need them. The last time I shot a rifle, a gun, honestly, I was a teenager. Yeah,
they were trying to convert diaspora boys into Israel man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How far did you get in that process?
You know, I had a pretty good shot, I think. Yeah.
So it worked.
Okay, so why do you think he carries this? Why do you think he brings the cat with him on this trip?
I think he doesn't have anywhere to go with it.
But it's just it's not the Gorfine's cat. It's just a cat that he found.
Well, so that's...
He's brought that cat from New York to that place, and then he abandons it.
And then
he abandons it there. He, like, I guess, runs it over later, right?
Well, this is the thing, is, like, he also decides not to get off the road and see the mother of his child. Yeah, and his child.
What was so sad, because when we were watching the scene together, there was the shot of just the moonlight hitting the cat.
Yeah.
As it slunk away into the darkness.
Well, that's the key. For me, that's the thing. There's lots of like moments of like seeing something you can barely see, but that for me is like what I thought of. That shot, that wide shot of the road and the woods and the moonlight hitting that tiny little animal and just like how pathetic it is and how, you know, it's like when people say you have to see a movie on the big screen because of this big epic action scene, but also like, you know,
It's small things too.
Like that's like a Pichat Pong, where a Seth Akul movie, like those movies work so well on a big screen because it's these wide shots with these tiny things happening in them.
But that's also time. I think a Pichat Pong, it's like using time as like a paintbrush, like memoria when, you know.
Yeah. The fact that you're stuck in the theater.
You're stuck in the theater when this person, you think this person is dead or has had their little death. But they were asleep. I mean, that's my favorite part of Memoria, is when the person was asleep or dead.
Actually, I haven't seen
it. And you're okay.
Well, no, but it's fine.
It's just this amazing part where he uses time as kind of the brush. I was explaining why I like this movie to someone who, you know, has an Instagram account that has like a million followers and is really in tune with what people like. And then she was just like, "Yeah, I don't think I would like that at all." I was like, cool. I mean,
if you're watching,
it's a very Eastern way of approach
and also,
to filmmaking.
Like,
it's different.
I'm sorry, but, and I don't mean to be like an oldie, but I can't imagine that movie would work. Even one frame of that movie would work when you're watching a 16:9 frame, like on a portrait phone, like in an Instagram feed. Like, it seems like it would just be like,
yeah, I don't think you would watch it on Instagram at all. Yeah. No. I was just saying, like,
It would be hard. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I would imagine that it would be hard to see that movie to like get what it was going for without watching some of his other movies, right? Like, would that be a good first movie from
I think Joe? Because it's got Tilda. Mm. You know, it's got an actor you could connect with. It's got a story. I say to everyone, you know, who's succeeding making state financed films in Europe and Asia to come to America and make a movie and try to win an audience over. Because it is not. It's a, you know.
It's a different ball game.
It's a different ball game. Yeah, it's tough.
And what are the rules of that ball game?
I have no idea. It's hard. You know, you have to believe. You have to think really long term, I guess.
Do you feel any, like, the situation you're describing, does that seem relevant to what's going on to all the artists in this movie? Like, they're trying to figure out how to get a toehold in the world?
Oh, like, yeah, Llewyn Davis is definitely trying to do it his way, and it's not working.
Yeah.
His way being the way of the purity, you know?
Yeah. And actually, okay, so that's my second point that I wanted to get back to from, like, 15 minutes ago, is that Hail Caesar is, like, is the character who joins Peter, Paul, and Mary. Like, Hail Caesar is the character who says, this has worth in and of itself, no matter how tainted it is by commerce. These productions are beautiful in their own right, and, like, a lot, so much talent and expression goes into them, even if they're, like, fundamentally compromised.
Mm-hmm.
Those two movies are in conversation with each other about, like, what it means to, like, make stuff for a living, make creative stuff for a living.
I mean, there's probably a somewhat of a randomness to the Coens' filmography that I love. I'm sure they're not, like, thinking about, like, okay, it would be really cool if the next one was this.
No.
But I'm sure there's, like, a bit of, like, there's a cool, it's kind of improvised in a nice way. It's just sort of, it's their impulse to do this one to be their next one. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's more impulsive, which I like.
I feel like if you look at Barton Fink and Llewyn Davis next to each other, they're both similarly, like, this is a young artist who's trying to find themselves in this industry with this whole mm-hmm. feedback loop of other people's approval. And mm-hmm. whereas Barton Fink is so, like, a film that, like, a younger person would make, where it's just like, the stakes here are death, like, annihilation is what's coming down.
But they're roasting themselves more. They're having more fun roasting the main character in Barton Fink, whereas in Llewyn Davis, they're kind of, like, with him. They're kind
That's
of
what
like,
I'm saying.
You know,
yeah, it's more nuanced. They're actually, like, there's a lot more. And I would just say, like, when people get hurt in Llewyn Davis, you really feel bad for them.
Yeah.
It's not just like, oh, that's a funny beat of pathos. It's like small things land really big in this film. Yeah, it's not so much a descent into hell. It's like a week that kind of is a cyclical week. This guy is realizing just how depressed he is. Like, when he's like, you know, I'm tired. I thought it was, I forget what he says, it's more than that. You know, it's like him just realizing that he's so fried out from the, hasn't dealt with the grief of his friend and just what his life has been and his family.
Luck and timing are against him. You know, it's like, there's a lot to relate to, sadly, in this movie where you're just like, so much of making, like, trying to make movies is, timing. Because you could have a great movie idea, a great script, but if the pieces don't come together in the right time frame, it becomes wrong to make it because you know it won't even connect the right way. And maybe it's been done, maybe someone else.
Or, like, someone else becomes president, or the culture shifts on you.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting, too. Or you know, or the culture shifts and it makes you feel like maybe you shouldn't be doing it, even though maybe, you know, who knows who's right.
Yeah.
I think it's, who's president during Inside Llewyn Davis? LBJ.
Isn't it Kennedy?
Yeah, Kennedy. Yeah.
Please, Mr. Kennedy. It's Kennedy.
61. Yeah. It's like 61.
Wow.
What year is Serious Man? It's after. Right?
I thought it was that's 67 or 68 or something.
Yeah. That's probably LBJ.
All the clips that you pulled out from this movie, what you're really tracking more than anything is the arc of him losing and carrying the cat with him to the Midwest, then deciding to abandon the cat and then hitting the cat. But even though there may be different cats throughout the film, the arc of the film is at the beginning, the cat's in danger. And at this low point, he, like, basically hits a cat and kills it. And then when he gets back to New York, the Gorfine's cat is, like, kind of miraculously okay.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot is forgiven.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just like it's circular, and it's all about, like, it makes you wonder, oh, if timing was a little bit different, could things have worked out in a different way? And then we're almost seeing, like, we're almost seeing, like, a slightly tangential version of the way it opened, which is how it ended, and it still ends the same way. So I guess it's sort of like this movie is all about, like, near missing and kind of the tenuous nature of succeeding on your own terms. Yeah.
Like karma, like the reincarnation and like constantly experiencing the same thing over and over again.
Also, there's something just about, like, there's a symbolic purpose of the cat and everything, and the kind of narrative purpose, but just also on, like, an experiential watching the film. It just puts you into that state of tension about trying to protect something very, very kind of delicate and very uncontrollable. Just the, you know, it's like the
He's trying to do right by the Gorfine still, even though he's a miserable prick. He's still trying to do right by them, and there's certain things that are just out of his control, and he can't control, and he tries to control, but he picks up the wrong cat.
Yeah, and you just look at the image of him, any like photo from this movie, it'll be him walking and he's got the guitar case and he's got the little baby cat, you know, and it's like that's the, like, it's like Mandalorian, it's like all this stuff where it's just like you put a guy with like his like axe, you know, and his
show what the movie's about. Yeah.
The tiny little like the it's an innocent little light that he's trying to protect, you know. Yeah. And I feel like that's what You meet him at the beginning, and he's the kind of guy who, like, can't even stay over at someone's house without endangering this little cat. And then there's all this, like, tension about, can I protect the cat? Can I not protect? And then it's, like, finally at the end, the moment where it's the cat is slinking away in the moonlight is I've really just blown it. I've just let it go.
Yeah.
It's like reaching out to something, reaching out to grab something, and it disappears before you reach out, basically, is what that shot feels like to me. It's just loss. Profound, lonely loss.
It's one of the saddest images.
And absurd, because, you know,
that could be
usually hit a deer, but instead it's a cat. Yeah.
Well, also, it's like, because
he's on
really
one of those roads that
is that even really the same cat?
Like,
that could have been a third
not.
Cat.
Of course,
it could have been just like a random. The idea that he would like drive hundreds of miles and then on the way back, like a day later, he would hit the same cat. That's its own coincidence too.
And maybe he would be wise to think it was the same one, because maybe he would then believe in God and believe he was destined for success and continue down the righteous path. Sometimes if this is too personal, but like when I feel like when things are working out for you, do you ever feel like maybe like, oh, like I get why basketball players believe in God, like because things are working out so generously for them. They're like, oh, yeah, God has chosen a path for me. Like things are. Like, of course it would happen this way. It's the hardest road, but like it's going to work out. And it makes you kind of believe in a higher power, and it makes you want to continue manifesting things for yourself. When you think that the world is a cold place and you have to make things happen for yourself, maybe that's a nice way to view things. But I don't know why I brought that up, but I think it's interesting for a character like Lewin, who's basically like given up and kind of feels like, he's not chosen, and there isn't someone looking out for him, and there isn't a higher power, you know, testing him and making sure he having things work out for him.
Do you feel like God is testing like Larry and Lewin in similar kind of ways?
That's what they believe that.
Yeah,
which is, you know, maybe interesting. I think it's people's belief in it which makes it interesting. Yeah, Lewin is someone that probably doesn't believe that he is being tested, and that someone is looking out for him, and then he'll be able to succeed. Larry, I think, does believe that, yeah.
The part with the cat kind of veers into magic almost in the same way that him up on the roof adjusting the antenna and being able to hear it. The films are very grounded in the real world, but then they become kind of supernatural at moments.
You just get this glimmer. Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of what I was hoping. That's kind of where I was hoping to get to today's.
Was that they're being tested by God? And that's what
sorry if we were veering. If we were veering, well, I veered off.
No.
That
they're being tested by God.
That's the
and
point.
That's what
that was what I intended from the very beginning.
That these are messages and signs that are coming, lighting up the pathway, the right and the wrong choices.
Yeah, I just couldn't tell you that from the beginning. Or we never would have gotten there on our own.
Yeah. Bob Dylan was a, you know, religious man for a reason.
Yeah. He came to Christianity later in life, but ultimately he saw its truth. Yeah.
Well, can I ask you guys a question just in all these scenes, because we've just looked at them. Can we just talk about like the impact on the audience, like watching it as a person, just having all these scenes where there's something that you can see, or you can see a bit of it and then you see more of it, or like what kind of mindset?
There's suspense in all of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of like got to this sort of like more subtle place, but I think terror and like horror movie tropes are also operating in all of these scenes in their own way.
Yeah. And there's, you know, other movies you could have taken from too. Barton Fink for sure. And definitely some parts of Buster Scruggs, which I watched that. That's the last Coen Brothers movie I watched. Really love Dudley Dursley's little career renaissance.
Who's Dudley Dursley?
He, In the Harry Potter movies, he plays Dudley Dursley, which is Harry Potter's mean.
Oh, Melling. Harry Melling.
Harry Melling, yeah.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome in Buster Scruggs. I just saw him in this Christian Bale movie where he plays Edgar Allan Poe. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's very weird in it. But yeah, when you see something you don't see, when you said that, I was like, oh, you mean like when Buster Scruggs dies? Because I was just thinking it in a different way. Like, oh, like when he doesn't see that that guy's about to kill
that
him.
That guy's about to kill him. Oh. Yeah.
Someone doesn't see that Buster Scruggs about to kill them. I don't know. I love that movie. It's so interesting they decided to do that a series of shorts. And everyone has like a different view on which one they like. And I loved the last one. And I was like, yeah. I looked at a bunch of rankings. Everyone put that one last. I was like, okay.
You want to do Joel or Ethan?
Joel or Ethan? Yeah, you want to play Joel or Ethan?
Who are you, Joel or Ethan? Who's Joel and who's Ethan?
That's a good question. I think just by height, I think I'm Ethan and Ray's Joel.
Okay, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, something. I would agree. I think Ray is Joel and you're Ethan.
Okay.
But you know, Joel needed Ethan.
Joel needed Ethan.
And Ethan needed Joel.
We're going to find out soon enough.
The question is, on the set, Billy Bob Thornton was giving real haircuts to extras and crew members. Did you get one? Are you kidding? Question mark.
Wait, who said, are you kidding?
The
one quote is, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Joel.
I say Ethan.
It's Ethan.
Damn. Okay.
Let's do it. Okay.
Good job. I gotta brush up. I don't really know them too much as personalities.
Playboy. Are you consciously trying to do something different each time out? Blank. Not really. We were out filming this scene in Fargo where a car is approaching in the distance on an empty stretch of highway as Steve Buscemi is dragging a state trooper's body off the road. As we were shooting that scene, Blank and I looked at each other and we both said, it seems like we've been here before. There's an almost identical scene in Blood Simple. It's a complete accident.
That sounds like Joel to me.
I'm just going to go with Ray because I have no idea. I would have honestly thought Ethan. I would have thought Ethan first. I'll go Ethan just for the sake of the game.
It's Joel.
Yeah. So I should. It was so Joel. My ideas of who they are wrong.
Can you look up a quote and then you test me and Jordan?
I'll just look up Coen Brothers quotes. Six Coen Brothers quotes to inspire your filmmaking process.
This is good. This is what we need to set us off on the right track.
Like any kind of writing, there are good days and frustrating days. But even frustrating days could be rewarding sometimes.
That sounds like Ethan to me.
I'm going to say Joel.
It's Ethan. So I guess Ethan is the esoteric one, I guess, right? Or the existential one.
Well, this was so good.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Xander. I enjoyed this so much.
Yeah, I hope it's entertaining. I wish I could have been there in person, but... The 2D, do you ever feel like it sometimes isn't like I forget that I'm talking to like a two-dimensional screen. It's like sometimes it's a bummer. I'm like, oh, I wish I could actually be in the room. And sometimes you're like, oh, I'm glad I could shut you in meetings. But yeah, this is a meeting I wish I was in the room. Yeah.
Is there anything you're working on right now that you're excited about? Or like what's...
Everyone's going to have to wait patiently. And I know everyone's desperately waiting for the Lance Lizardi movie. So tell all your famous actors to approach my agents.
but
come be in the movie. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You're working on a feature version of your short Lance Lizardi.
Yeah. I guess it's a spinoff in a way. The idea led to the other idea. And I'm doing a documentary actually. Yeah. I've been shooting a documentary since the last summer. That's what I'm also spending time doing in Florida. I don't really want to talk too much about that, but I'll show you the sizzle for it. And yeah, I've been writing another movie that's in somewhat inspired by High Plains Drifter, Deliverance, and some new ideas. Yeah, but it's contemporary. Yeah, so it's nothing like that at the same time. Yeah.
Sounds cool.
Sounds very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like a monster movie. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Xander. It was inspiring and illuminating to talk to you today. And thank you for joining our study group.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. And I look forward to seeing how this evolves. And I hope it's only up from here. Only.
To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow, Austin Purnell as Red, Sam Wall as the pilot, and J.D. Amato as the bombardier.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandaraja.
To the White Sea theme music, written and performed by Dan Romer.
The summer had inhaled and held its breath too long. The winter looked the same as if it never had gone. And through an open window where no curtain hung, I saw you. I saw you.